Okay, now it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to our speaker who I met at a, a sponsorship thing that they had in Lompoc, and I highly recommend, I believe they're going to have something else coming up, but he was on the panel, and I really enjoyed what he had to say, so I asked him to come up and share with us, and this is Todd W. from Lompoc.
My name is Todd Wilson. I'm an alcoholic. And first off, I want to thank Lynn for asking me to speak. I consider it an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And over my time of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I not only consider it an honor and a privilege, but a responsibility and a requirement. I'm not supposed to say no to any unreasonable AA request, and it's not unreasonable for me to do something that helps me continue or maintain my sobriety, and that's the reason why I'm here tonight. So it's clear in Bill Wilson's story why we gather, and we gather for the newcomers. So I want to welcome our newcomers who are identified tonight, and that you're welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to, and you don't have to drink even if you want to, that you're in a safe place and you're around people that know what you're going through. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. That's what the miracle is of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that I'm standing up here sober today, or that I was able to drive from Lompoc to here, which isn't a big deal. But when you have kids, it kind of is. But it's that I'm able to relate to another human being that felt the same way that I did when I was in that place, you know, that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, that bitter morass of self-pity that Bill talks about in his story. I know what that feels like, and I can communicate that to another alcoholic of my type, the hopeless variety, in order to help them maybe crawl out of that abyss and enjoy what I've enjoyed for the past 7 years as a life beyond my wildest dreams. So I want to thank Carrie for driving with me tonight. So I appreciate that. And we'll get to the particulars here. Speaker meetings have a certain format, and I choose to stick to it. I already spoke my name. I have a sponsor. His name's John Cordero. He's been my sponsor since 1999, but my sobriety date is November 18, 2010. I say that's my current sobriety date. I've had other sobriety dates before that one, but this is my current sobriety date. And what's different about this time than last time, that I stayed sober, is what's different about this time than last time. Let's see. It's also good to see Billy. I've seen you a couple months back, but it was been a long time since then, so... he knows about one of my go-arounds in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I still consider you a good friend, and would definitely hit the accept button if you called me. As an alcoholic, you know, I didn't know I was an alcoholic, obviously, you know, or I would have probably came to Alcoholics Anonymous at 6. I didn't start drinking at 6, but... I grew up not knowing what was wrong with me, and what was wrong with me is that I lived in an average household, on an average street, in an average neighborhood, with average parents who worked for a living. I didn't grow up needing anything. I didn't grow up with too much. You know, I was right in the middle. And what I've come to learn is that bugged the hell out of me, you know. I would think to myself, I would rather be dirt poor and getting the attention for being that way or being, you know, like a crazy rich Asian, like the movie right now. getting attention that way, you know. But being who I was in that skin, I remember as a kid laying in bed at night just dreaming that my life was something different than what it was. And that's before I even took a drink. That's before I even knew about anything that could change how I felt on the inside. Basically, I started drinking because I wanted to fit in. And It was the time, it was the 90s, it was the late 80s and the 90s, it was the time for of Spuds McKenzie and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and, you know, it was party time, you know, and that's what I did, you know, and what I found out was I was damn good at it, and so that's what my life consisted of. It, I didn't know that I actually have this illness that's threefold. That once I took ingested that alcohol inside of me, it set forth a craving that I couldn't control. I just thought I was having fun. I just thought that, you know, it's normal to start drinking on a Thursday night when you're in high school and then stop on a Tuesday night. You know, I thought that was normal. You know, I just thought I was better at it than my other friends who just stuck to Friday night and Saturday night and then were too hungover to do anything on Sunday, the wimps. You know, so that's what I did. You know, I partied. I didn't know there was anything wrong with it. You know, I rated the parties that I went to by how many people got sick, and the more people got sick, the better the party. And that's what I went after. I didn't know that I was actually trying to be somebody who I wasn't because I didn't like who I was inside. It took the work of Alcoholics Anonymous to help me figure that out. It took working the steps to help me figure that out. So, being a PhD at partying, because that's all I wanted to do. That's all I cared about doing. And partying costs money as well. You have to buy the stuff. You know, nobody gave it to me. I wasn't that good at partying. You know, I didn't get it for free. But at some point, you know, what happened in my life that we ended up moving, I ended up moving from North Carolina where I started my partying career to Lompoc with my mom, who had been divorced from my father, and she wanted to move back to be closer to her mom. So, you know, I figured I would come back and help her, you know, get adjusted. And my plan was, as soon as she was set up, I was going to go book it back to where I was Mr. Partier. You know, I'd already had a reputation, you know. I didn't want to leave that. You know, that's when you get a good reputation, you want to keep it. You know, it's like gold. You know, carry it around in your pocket, pull it out like a car. It's a Todd, party animal. And I would have to start that all over again if I stayed here. But like I said, Dr. Silthwaite talks about men and women essentially drink because they like the effect alcohol has on them. So just because I left the party scene didn't mean I wanted to stop partying. So, and at that point, it kind of changed. It changed in my life. You know, in the book, Bill talks about how liquor ceased becoming a luxury and it started becoming a necessity. And that's when it started to do that. You know, I was 18, 19, 20 years old. And, you know, I would try every liquor store and every grocery store to try to buy booze until I found the one that wouldn't card me. And then that's the one I would go to. So if I had to walk all the way across town to buy my bottle, that's what I did. I walked all the way across town, bought my bottle, got home, drank it because my mom was working to pay the bills because I was there helping her. And I would hide the bottles in my bedroom inside of the closet. So one day she asked me, she's like, "What are all these bottles doing in your closet?" And I told her, "Well, I'm collecting them, you know. I'm a collector now. They're going to be worth something someday." So by this time, an opportunity came for me to be able to, take the heat off of that situation, because then I was going to have to start really being able to hide the bottles, or actually have to find my way to the dumpster and throw it away. But there was an earthquake in Big Bear and in Landers, California at that time. And my uncle's homestead was 400 feet from the epicenter of the Landers earthquake. So his property got pretty tore up. So they asked me to go out there and help them. And so I went out there to actually kind of try to escape that situation, because I kind of felt like it was kind of getting out of control, because that's all I was doing, you know. My day consisted of eating popcorn and drinking Vaughn's whiskey, and that's what I did. And the family had to see that I was just falling down to a deep. And from my understanding, this was their idea to get me to go do something. So I went and worked with him for a while and earned a little money, and then made it back to Lompoc around Christmas time. We came back, and I came back to Lompoc around Christmas time, and I had a little money in my pocket, and I actually earned a car while I was out there. So now I had a car. I didn't have to walk across. And I turned 21 when I was out there, so I could go anywhere and buy my booze now. And at the time, I liked to go to this bar that was in Mission Hills in the village, so I would go there and drink there, you know. And they kind of don't like you to drink and drive. The cops don't think that's a good idea, especially when you're not aware what time of day it is. And you have a front lit headlight out and a back brake light that doesn't work. You just like stand out like a sore thumb. So don't do that. If you had any thoughts of doing that. I like a speaker I used to hear. He's like, people without a license are the best drivers. So he would suggest that nobody get a driver's license, and it would be much safer on the road. They both have two hands on the wheel. They hit their turn signal 5 miles before they turn. You know, so that's kind of how I should have been. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. So I get what most of us get. I get my first and only DUI. I made it all the way to my house, which really pissed me off, because I was in my parking spot. But I had lost my license. I had misplaced it. And so I couldn't give them identification that I actually lived there. So he took me in anyway. So still working on that resentment a little bit. So that was my first introduction into, you know, counseling, or I had to go to classes, you know, and they make you pay for them too, which I wasn't happy about that at all. And you're going to make me go to the classes and pay for them. So I started going to classes. Right now it's a social center, but the classes, it was Central Coast Headway. It was on the corner of Laurel and R Street in Lompoc. So I started, that was my first introduction of it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous, but they talked about AA and that. And so I had to get court card signed because I had probation. So, and what's nice about right there is there's a bar right there that's not there anymore. It's called the Whistle Stop. So I would go to that my AA class and get so thirsty that on the way home I had to stop by the Whistle Stop, and they made the best rum and cokes there. I'm telling you, just a little bit of coke, that's where I signed my court cards, and I got pretty good at it. So I would do some with the left hand, and I would do some with the red ink, then blue ink, and I would do it with my right hand. I'm like, they never know that I never set foot in an AA meeting. But I had all these court cards signed that said I did, so paid that fine, paid all that. So everything, so my DUI is done and over with, so... now I got to pay for it. So I got to pay for it. I still owed money from, I still owe money from the classes. I paid my fines, but I still owe money for the classes. So I had to get a job. So I got my first job in California. I was born in Lompoc. My dad was a CB. He was a CB station at Port Hueneme. My mom was a bartender. So I was screwed from the get. So that's where I was conceived, so to speak. So so living in Lompoc, you know, it kind of fits me like a like like a good sweater, you know. So getting a job there and having to pay that kind of blew my plans of going back to being King Party Animal in North Carolina, which where I lived, that was all you could do. There wasn't nothing. When you live out in the sticks, there's not much you can do. So I started working, and the job that I got was I was a graveyard cook at the Carrolls, because my mom was the bar manager there. So so I started working there, and graveyards are a funny shift. Normal people, normal partiers like to party during that time. So I would always get started partying and then have to go to work and then get off of work and everybody's done partying. So I just started partying at work. And I found out that I'm okay partying by myself. And I was introduced to other substances at that point that would help me do my job really good. So the morning crew really loved working after I was working that night. So everything was clean, everything was stocked. I was always on time. I never left early. I was a really good employee, and I thought that made me a better employee, actually. And it was also nice because my mom was the manager of the bar, so when I went to the bar, I didn't have to pay for anything. Matter of fact, a group of us that worked there, we pretty much got everybody that worked there kicked out from the bar. They couldn't go back to the bar anymore because we kind of tore it up on a regular basis. So at this point, you know, I'm working and I'm drinking and I'm doing other substances, and you know, my life is starting to head down the tubes pretty quickly. You know, I'm doing these other substances and I'm drinking and I'm hanging around those people that where you get those substances from, and started to hang around with them more, and then I figured, well, if I'm around there all the time, maybe they'll give me a job, you know. So I figured that, you know, if I'm always there, maybe they'll do, because they were always I was easy to manipulate to do things. So if they wanted me to do something, I would do it. If I thought I was going to get something that I really wanted, or sometimes it was just that reputation, you know. And I got into a new venture, a new business, and I became a drug dealer. And it's not a good pension plan. You don't have to do an application. There's no background checks. It's pretty much, are you a cop? No, you're hired. And so that's what I did. Unfortunately for me is that monkeys can't sell bananas. So I became my best customer. And when you're the one that owes yourself the most money, you can't really kick your own butt and get paid. So then I had to come up with creative ways to be able to pay my debts. And doing that made me an easy mark for the police. And so finally I was arrested for doing that, like everybody does, that I believe that has my illness, the illness of the mind, you know, the illness of the body, and the last part, which is the most important part, is the spiritual illness. But I didn't know that at the time, and so I got rang up pretty good on that. So I had to do a little bit of jail time on that one. I got the nice 5-year felony probation. So at that point, that's when I was, and I had to do an in-month program, a 6-month program. I got introduced into the ARC and Carpinteria, and that's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous for real for the first time. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I was an addict, because addicts are cooler, you know? they're cooler. I would have got a tattoo said I was an addict if it made me look cooler. I wasn't going to admit that I was an alcoholic. I didn't look like an alcoholic. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. An alcoholic didn't look like an alcoholic when I looked in the mirror. I looked like a dirty scumbag, and I looked like someone who was letting his family down. But I didn't look like an alcoholic, so I just thought I was an addict. So if I just stay away from that stuff, I'll be okay. So as soon as I graduated from the ARC, my first stop, I changed bars by this time. I didn't go to the Whistle Stop anymore. I went to Your Place or Mine because they serve these big old beers because, you know, if I start drinking those rum and cokes, I'll be at the drug house in no time. But those big, tall beers, I can handle that. So it comes out of can't. I can't handle beer. I can't handle alcohol, but I didn't know that. So I always end up at the dope man's house. Doesn't matter what the grain of alcohol, no grain alcohol, corn liquor, any kind of liquor, sherry, I'm going to end up at the drug house because I want to keep partying because I'm the party animal. So of course, when you get 5 years felony probation, they give you the drug testing and, they made me pay for the drug testing too, which kind of pissed me off. It's $25 a test. So I was like, man. So I would do these tests, and I was getting in the hole every time I did a test. And I gave a couple dirty tests and had to do, a little bit of time for that. I got to learn how to dig graves at the cemetery because of a dirty test. I had to do 60 days out there, and then the second to last probation officer I had, I was telling him, "Hey man, it's these testing that's killing me. I'm having to pay for these tests, and I'm getting in the hole, and I'm getting stressed out, and I can't handle the stress. So I go have a drink and." Next thing I know, I'm using, he's like, he said, you know what, Todd, I'll tell you what, you give me 6 months of clean testing and I'll take you off the color code testing. I'm like, all right, I can do that. I can do 6 months. That's no problem. Cause I've done it before, cause at certain points of my drinking and using career, I would take it to the point where I was able to stop on my own volition. I was able to stop because either I ran out of money or, nobody would hang out with me anymore. But I was able to stop, and I was able to stay stopped for some time, but I wasn't able to stay stopped forever. And I never stayed stopped on everything. There was always something. It was always just beer this time, or I was just doing, I was just going to smoke some weed, but I never stopped everything at once. So by this time, he told me, he's like, you give me 6 months of clean testing. And I share this story because it talks about in the book that, and it talks about Dr. Silford, that alcoholics have a positive genius to get tight at the exact wrong moment. So I made it 5 months and 2 weeks without giving a dirty test. And I gave a dirty test. And the probation officer says, this is dirty. And I'm like, what? I knew it was dirty. I knew I was leaving. So I actually went to give the test in my slippers because I knew I was getting locked up. And I thought I was going to stay locked up that time. But that wasn't the case. They gave me one more shot, and they put me back in county jail for another 90-day stint, which was like my fourth one this time. And so they kind of knew me by first name basis over there, which isn't good. But this time I had heard about a friend of mine who was in county jail, and I was actually in there with him his last time in there, and he was in this program called Sheriff's Treatment Program. And I considered this guy to be the worst of the worst. Like he was what I considered an addict and alcoholic of the hopeless variety. We called him Skeletor. That's how bad he got. And he was able, when he got out, he was able to get, and he would go to jail and he would get out and he would be all healthy. And he does what we all do when we get out. Hey, I'm going to get a job this time. I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to do all these things. And we have all these big plans. And then something happens when you walk out that door at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. It's like there's a brain washer, and it just all that stuff goes out. And generally, most of us that have my illness end up doing what we always do, especially if you go back in the same place expecting doing the same thing, expecting getting a different result, which is definition of insanity. I've seen it over there on the wall. So I heard about that. So this time I actually tried to do something productive while I was in there. So the first time I was in jail, I did something productive too. I got my GED. They wanted to put my name on the wall, and I said, no. Don't put my name in the wall on there. I'll just say anonymous. You can put anonymous person. That was the first time I was anonymous. So I went in the Sheriff's Treatment Program, and I got introduced in what I consider real recovery is. You know, when I was in the ARC, I did the steps and I did the things, but I did it because I'm good at doing things to get me what I need to get. If there's an end game, I will figure out how to get to that end game. No matter what it does to anybody else around me. And so I was introduced to then, and I was introduced to a program that was a lot more focused on living. Newhouse 2 and Newhouse 3. The Newhouse is a very good program in Santa Barbara. It's one of them. It's as close as you can get to having your own place and being a productive person without being shut in to me as you can. You get a job, you pay rent, and you have to go to meetings, and you have to get a sponsor, and you have to get all those things. So I went there and I got a sponsor. Well, actually, the sponsor was gotten for me because I was told that I was going to pick an easy sponsor. So they picked the meanest guy in Santa Barbara to be my sponsor. He's not mean no more though, which is kind of crazy. He's the person that I most want to be like in life. And if anybody in this room doesn't have a sponsor yet, and you're thinking about how you're going to pick a sponsor, I would suggest that be one of the boxes that you want to check off. That person want to be somebody. Do you want to be like that person? So that's when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was introduced to steps, and I was working the steps. And I was sponsoring people, and my life was changing, and I had a good job, and I had all these things, and I was going to all these meetings, and I had all these people telling me I was doing good, but I had a dirty little secret that I didn't have, that nobody could know about, and that's like when I first came out, and for like the first month, I would go out and smoke weed with a couple of my friends that I used to hang out with, and that's all we did, and nothing happened. I didn't go to the dope man's house, when I did that. So me being the great thinker and the guy who's done so well up to this time made a decision that it's different. I kind of looked at it as like smoking a cigar. I see people that would quit smoking, but they would still smoke a cigar. And I'm like, well, if they can do that, I can still smoke weed. That's how crazy my mind works. I would look at it as like, I would only do that on certain occasions. So I look at myself as being, I was a social person. After working the steps and knowing what my fears were and all, because I was still going to meetings, still sponsoring guys, and I told myself that as long as nobody asks me about it, I don't have to lie about it. But I don't have to say anything about it either, because I justified it in my mind that it was no different than a non-smoker smoking cigars or not inhaling cigars. But trust me, that's not the case. At this time, I actually didn't know it at the time, but I met my future wife, and Carrie. I met Carrie. She was, and it was like instant family, you know. And it's something that through working the steps that I thought I would never be able to have because of my irresponsibility and things. And the bad thing about that is that I moved her across the country and relapsed. So the short story with that is, and then I moved back over the country back. So you know, I moved to Pennsylvania to keep pursuing the career that I was going. But really, what I was doing, I was running away from Alcoholics Anonymous because that dirty little secret was starting to eat me up inside. And I couldn't take it anymore. And each day would be the day that I would wake up and I'd say, this is the day I'm going to just come clean to everybody. And I would see that people would be coming clean doing the same thing. I'm like, I can do that. But I couldn't. So I took the easy way out, which is moving 3,000 miles away. And getting a family and putting them through hell for the next 7 years because of that. Eventually, if you turn an egg timer, the egg timer is going to go to the point where it's going to ding. And that's what happened with me. Eventually, what that did, that ended me living with my father-in-law who was terminal with cancer, justifying mooching off of him because I was taking care of him. But really, we were just using his place because we didn't have a place to go, because at that point, I was about as low of a person as you could get. You know, domestic violence creeped up in my life, something that I never thought I would ever be a part of. And at that point, I knew something had to change. And but I still couldn't do it. You know, I would wake up every morning, and just like what I would want to wake up every morning and tell myself, this is the day I was going to admit to occasionally smoking marijuana and still claiming sobriety. Every day I would wake up and say, okay, this is the day I'm just gonna go drive and just get away and not tell them that I'm leaving, and they'll be better off without me. And maybe I'll go get sober, and maybe I won't. I don't know. All I knew is that I wasn't doing anything for them. I was a slave to the illness at that point. You know, in one of Clancy's talks, he talks about how he would hate the times when he would go home and he'd get those looks from his family, and those looks would tell him, like, and that look they would give him, like, how could you? How could you do it again? How could you do this to us again? And to me, my bottom was when I was getting those looks, and that look was staring me at it in the mirror. And I could not, that point of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and that's what the bitter morass of self-pity that Bill was talking about. That was a new level of it. And but I was luckier than most because I had been introduced to a new way of living and to a new way of life. And I knew what I needed to do. It just, something had to be done to get me there, you know. And one night, the whole reason why we moved from Arizona to back to California is because my wife was pregnant. And we thought it would be easier. I don't know. I was so high at the time and so drunk, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Seemed like a good idea. But one night her water broke, and she said she wanted to have the baby in Lompoc. So that's what we did. So I drove her from Delano, California to Lompoc, California in labor so she could have the baby there. So, and in my mind, oh, that was going to be good because, you know, I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I was high. And so What that come to be was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. One of the most beautiful things that can ever happen, and that's the birth of a child. Because that child was born under the influence, which got me back into the system, which got me back into Alcoholics Anonymous, which was probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me. So that little boy, that's the little boy that's that bugs the crap out of me almost every day. He's the reason why I'm standing here. He is the reason why I was able to stop all that stuff and go back to what I knew that worked and do it right this time. You know, we went through counseling again, and I started going back to meetings, and we had a CWS case, and we had to jump through all those hoops to do that. Which for me, it didn't feel like I was jumping through any hoops. It felt like that, you know, they were giving me time to be able to figure it out. It doesn't mean I was happy about it, but what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, you got to do the next right action, and sometimes that next right action isn't part of my plan. And I got to understand that my plan sucks. You know, my plan gets me homeless, living in River Park. That's where my plan got me. And so I try not to have too many plans these days. So, but you know, when you're the only thing you think about most of the time, it's kind of hard to do. But luckily my sponsor has the same phone number, and I was able to contact him, and I started going through the steps again. I went and did my fourth step, and I started making the amends again. And I often like to joke is that if I ever want to make my sponsor laugh, I'll go do a fourth step with him. Because I'm just so out there with my brain, and he thinks it's the funniest thing, and he knows it pisses me off, and he just laughs harder even. And so, when I did the steps the first time and still relapsed, I still gained that knowledge. That knowledge didn't go anywhere. So if there's any retreads in the room, you know, there's no reason to, I find it no reason to look at that as a negative. If anything, if I would have stayed sober from that very point, it would have probably made my ego so big that I would have probably ended up going out and never coming back. This is the path that I had to choose to be where I'm at right now, which is living a life that I could not believe that I could attain. You know, sometimes things don't work out in certain ways. Relationships don't work out in certain ways, but that doesn't mean that that I can't still try to be a better person. And what Alcoholics Anonymous gives me is a way to become a better person through work and self-sacrifice through others. And that's what I've learned doing the steps, is that the only way, if I'm going to get anything out of this life, is I got to do something for somebody else. And that's the way that my selfishness works in reverse. You know, when I first started praying, you know, I felt like a hypocrite. Because the only reason why I was praying, because I thought I was going to get something out of it. And I didn't understand at the beginning that the prayer is mainly just a surrender. It's a tiny surrender, you know, and I got to surrender every day if I want to maintain a level of sobriety that gives me some happiness and joy in life. Today, you know, through my work, and I now have a job that I kind of enjoy. It definitely pays the bills. It's a little bit more responsibility than I like some of the times, and it takes me away from more of my family than I like, which is someday good for them. And I'm not able to do as much with Alcoholics Anonymous as I've done in the past. But I often tell my sponsees it's about quality more than quantity. It's okay if you're able to go do 120 meetings in 30 days. It's okay. But for me, I have to be able to have that balance. I have to be able to fit my life into Alcoholics Anonymous that's going to be sustainable. You know, I can't depend on a meeting or a group of people that I'm not going to be able to know I can go there. And I didn't mention my home group. I do have a home group. It's the Wednesday night book study. We call it the bingo meeting in Lompoc at the Half Century Club. Everybody's invited. It's from 7 to 8. I consider it a great meeting. Right now, that's really the only meeting I consistently am able to go to with my job and my family. So, and it's about, to me, that intensive work with another alcoholic, the intensive part is subject to what you can do. It's an avocation. It's not my job, but it is a requirement that I do it. You know, I cannot tell myself, well, I don't feel like going there tonight, or, you know, I don't feel like working with the steps with the newcomer because I got a full life now because of what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. You know, because that's part of what I did before. You know, I started working that I got mine, now you get yours brand of Alcoholics Anonymous that kills people like me. And it damn near killed me. And I was one of the lucky ones to make it back. So again, I want to thank Lynn for inviting me to speak tonight. I want to thank all of you for being here. And thanks a lot for my life.
Give Todd another hand. Thank you, Todd.